to be able to develop strength. Strength can't be developed without that type of resistance. And so, realizing that God put us in this world to develop character, I began to understand that He had to create the world in such a way that the world offered resistance to character development, and yet also provided a safe environment in which to develop and to grow that character. And perhaps even more so, provided a feedback mechanism. Imagine if you were working out in a gym and you had no way of measuring your progress. You had no way of measuring your added strength. If you had no way of being able to notice your reduction in weight. That feedback is really important to keep you focused, to keep you straight, and to keep you going. So I began to understand that the world, and particularly the workplace, as we're going to discuss today, is a massive gym. It's a character gym. It's a place where you can build yourself, develop yourself, but where you're offered some serious resistance in the process. Mussar is the building of character. If I were to try and explain what Mussar is in a very fundamental level without getting sophisticated, problematic, and many of you have had a great deal of experience already, both practically and theoretically with Mussar. Mussar is the art of character development. And so, if I were to rephrase what I've just said, I would say God created us and put us in this world for Mussar. He put us in this world to develop character. He put us in this world to overcome the resistance and thereby strengthen our character muscles, our moral muscles, our ethical muscles. That's what Mussar really is. And it's interesting that the word Mussar has many different roots to it, but one of the roots is Yisurin, which means pain. Where there's no pain, there's no gain. If you're working in a gym and you're not feeling any pain from the resistance that the weights and gravity is offering you, and it's all very easy and you're lifting up these weights without any big difficulty, you know you're not progressing. You know you're not developing and building muscle. Now, so it is with Mussar. There is a pain involved in Mussar. There is a discomfort in the countering of resistance in day-to-day life that builds our strength. And being able to be tuned into that discomfort, being able to be tuned into that that pain at times, is what enables us to know that we're on the right track. But we also need feedback. And business provides not only the gym, not only provides the resistance, but it also provides the opportunity for growth and immediate feedback. And we'll discuss that in a few minutes, how the feedback mechanism works. That if you're in business, and I talk of business very broadly, we're all in business. We're all in some way or another serving others, working with others, providing an offering to others, adding value to others. Whether we're doing it in a professional area or we're doing it in a business area or we're just doing it within our own families as a father or a mother, all of those are business in the sense that we have customers, we have people who are benefiting from the value we add, and we are trying to add value to them. So when I talk about business, I'm talking about it in the widest sense of the workplace, but even more than that, of life, of an interactive life where people are serving one another, where people are making that kind of effort. So let's look at business a little bit more closely. And there's something really odd about business. And through the understanding of this oddity, we'll gain insight into the fact that I'm not going to talk to you about Mussar in the workplace or Mussar at the workplace. I'm going to talk to you about Mussar through the workplace. The workplace as one of our most powerful tools of Mussar. The workplace is one of our most powerful informants of how we're progressing. The workplace is the most wonderful character gym in which we can develop ourselves and practice the art of Mussar. So let's look at business a little bit more clearly and say business at its core is odd in that if you look at the main stakeholders of any business, what they put in and what they expect out. So you have investors who put money into a business. They invest capital into a business. They clearly expect more return than they invested. If they invested $100, they're going to want to get that $100 back one day, and in the meantime to be getting $10 or $20 every single year. So they want a whole lot more than they invested. You have creditors who've lent money to the business, and they want their capital back, and they want interest, so they want more than they've loaned. You have customers who want more value than the price they're paying. You have employees who want salaries and payment in excess of the cost of their work. Every stakeholder in a business is expecting more out of the business than they put in. And so you've got to ask yourself, where does that more come from? How does one create value? Because that's what a business is. You create value. It isn't just accumulating value. It's creating value where there was no value before. So if you take everything that's been put into the business, the credits that's been provided by creditors and the capital that's provided by investors and the cash flow that's provided by customers and the labor that's provided by employees, we've got to create even more value than all of that so that there's some profit at the end of the day. How do we create value? What is the art of creating value? And the art of creating value is the need to be continuously concerned about the well-being of others before oneself. A manager in a business has to be constantly concerned that his investors are getting their returns, that their creditors are being paid their interest, that their employees are fulfilled and satisfied and being fairly paid, that customers are getting great value, more than they could get anywhere else. So 24 hours a day, the entrepreneur or the business leader or the manager of a business has his mind on the well-being of others. And if he keeps his mind focused on the well-being of others, he benefits from that ultimately. He or she is the manager of the business, the founder of the business, the entrepreneur who leads the business, gains the most benefit from putting the interests of their stakeholders before their own personal interests. Can you think of any greater Musa experience than that? That all your time is devoted to thinking about others. And yes, it's true that you're going to profit from that. That's the nature of the world. That's how God created the world. If we do the right thing, we ultimately benefit, sometimes in this world, sometimes in the world to come. The fact that we're going to benefit from doing the right thing doesn't in any way undermine the value of that right thing that we're actually doing. So let's look at that a little bit further and notice with interest that when man was first created and put in the Garden of Eden, God gives one commandment to Adam and Eve. He places them in the garden, la'ovda u'lashomra, to work the garden and to protect it. And the rabbis point out that there's a grammatical difficulty. Those of you familiar with Hebrew know that every noun in Hebrew has either a masculine or a feminine gender, and that adjectives and verbs need to match the gender. And so the Garden of Eden, the garden, gan, is a word of masculine gender. And yet when God says in the Torah, I've placed you here, la'ovda u'lashomra, to work the garden and to protect it, he uses the feminine, to protect her, to work her and protect her. What is that feminine noun that he's referring to? It can't be only the garden. And the rabbis say that's the Torah. They have to work the Torah and protect the Torah, work God's will and protect God's will, work the values of Judaism and protect the values of Judaism. That's part of their work. So then I ask you, what was their task really? Were they tasked with caring for the garden, or were they tasked with caring for the Torah? The answer is it's one and the same thing. They were tasked at that time to care for the Torah through their care of the garden. And it's so interesting that that word avodah means both work and spiritual practice. The temple service is called avodah. Musar is called an avodah. It's called a practice, a spiritual practice. Labor, work, business is called avodah. It's called work. So in the Garden of Eden, with that first mitzvah, la'ovda u'lashomra, the two meanings of the word avodah, spiritual practice and work, intersect. They meet and they synthesize and they become one. That oneness of spiritual practice and workplace is the oneness of the Torah, is the oneness of Jewish life. And so the most apt translation for the word avodo that would cover both of these realms would be service. We have temple service, and we have service of others through business. Business allows service to take place. Business allows one to completely engross oneself and completely surround oneself with the idea of service. And God says, I've put you in this world. I've put mankind, I've put humankind in this world. La'ovda al-shamra, I've put you in this world to serve. You serve God, you serve your nation, you serve the Torah, you serve one another. You choose who you want to serve, at what time, at what period you want to serve. You choose how to serve, but you don't escape service. The purpose of being in this world is to serve. And when a person is in service, their ego, their egotism is diminished and can be almost entirely eradicated. The more one is able to engage oneself in the well-being of another or of another cause, the more one is able to engage oneself in the act of service, the smaller becomes the degree of egotism that the individual experiences. And so if Musar is the diminishment of egotism, which is certainly one of its most primary functions, then again, service is the method. Service is the way we do this. Service is the way we diminish ego and the way we diminish egotism in our day-to-day life through serving. And that takes us back to Viktor Frankl's very powerful statement that happiness is not something that can be pursued. Happiness ensues. And it ensues from the degree to which an individual forgets him or herself in the service of something bigger than themselves or someone other than themselves. By the extent to which we engage ourselves in the well-being of another or of a great cause, to that extent we're able to find happiness. And that's why love is such an important method, such an important practice in the pursuit of happiness, in the desire for happiness. Because in love, one is putting another one before oneself. If one is putting oneself first, there isn't love. If one's putting oneself first, there isn't a business. And that's really interesting, that something as soft and romantic as love and something as assumed to be so hard and self-centered as business have such a common core. At the end of the day, you've got to be putting somebody else before yourself if you want to succeed. If you want to succeed in love, your loved one comes first. If you want to succeed in business, your customers and stakeholders come first. And that practice is the practice of Musar. Darwin himself made an interesting comment I just discovered recently in saying that a tribe with many people acting like givers would be victorious over most other tribes, and this would be natural selection. So the survival of the fittest, Darwin argues, is not just everybody grabbing whatever they can and the person or the species that grabs the most is the one that survives. No, says Darwin, a tribe with many people acting like givers would be victorious over most other tribes. If everybody has the common good at mind, if everybody is working for something bigger, if everybody's trying to support somebody else, that's the tribe that's going to be the most powerful. There's a beautiful statement of the rabbis in the Talmud talking about the poverty that existed at one of the periods in Jewish history. And it was described by saying that, I think it was 6 disciples used to cover themselves with 1 blanket. There was only 1 blanket to share among 6 people. It might have been more. And one of my teachers, Reb Chaim Shmuelevitz, the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir Yeshiva at the time, used to talk about that and say, how could 6 people possibly be covered with 1 blanket? And you can imagine in that time of poverty, the blanket wasn't huge. This wasn't a king-size blanket. This was just a 1-man blanket. How do 6 people get themselves covered with 1 blanket? And Reb Chaim Shmuelevitz used to say, if each of the 6 is busy trying to get the blanket over themselves, there's no way 6 people can manage with 1 blanket. But if each of the 6 is busy worrying how the other 5 should be covered, then all 6 can find warmth under the 1 blanket. And that's the essence of business. If everybody's worrying about how they can get more out of it than anybody else, the business collapses ultimately. Just as a relationship collapses if two parties are both in it for themselves. But if every person in the business, if every leader and every manager and every person working and serving is worried about service, serving others, then the business flourishes and business does well. And so generosity, putting others first, becomes the most important function of a business. I call generosity the powerhouse of a business. If we could just move to the first slide, just to see the enormous power that generosity has. And I'm going to explain to you how it's so functional and so important in a business. But our ability to give who we are and what we have for the benefit of one another is perhaps the most valuable human attribute. In fact, it may be the singular character we possess that has the capacity to transform the world. I did see this quoted, and I could never find out who actually said it. And it may be a combination of a few different people, but it so clearly expresses the power of generosity to transform. It transforms the self because it diminishes ego and egotism, and it transforms others because of its power, because of what generosity is. And even in business, I'm going to show to you how in business it's the key to business success and to success in the workplace. Moving on to the next slide, I just want to define a little bit what we mean by generosity. I want to distinguish between generosity and charity. There are two kinds of generosity. There's a generosity which is giving charity, and that's a great thing to do and a wonderful thing to do, and that's also an act of musar, to give charity, to give tzedakah. But there's another kind of generosity, which means always creating value so that you're consistently giving more than you're receiving. And that means checking in with yourself in every situation. You're having a conversation, you're at a dinner, you're at a Shabbat table, you're teaching, you're serving, whatever. Checking in with yourself, am I creating value? Am I putting more in than I'm taking out? That's what I mean by generosity for the purposes of this conversation. So again, I don't expect a business to be generous in charity in the sense of giving all of its profits away. That wouldn't be sustainable. But for a business leader or manager or anybody in the workplace to be consistently thinking about, am I adding enough value? Am I giving more than I'm taking? That certainly is something that one is able to do and needs to do. Generosity means being secure enough to put the interests of others before your own. Generosity needs security. And if I can just pause there a moment and take you to the statement in the Torah, in the Bible, which forms the foundation of all ethics throughout the world, in every culture and in every religion. Love your neighbor as yourself. The Torah does not say more than yourself. The Torah says as yourself. Because the degree to which you love yourself caps your ability to love other people. You have to be secure within yourself. You have to value yourself and care about yourself and honor yourself in order to be generous to others and put others' interests before your own. Generosity means giving where there'll be gratitude, graciousness, and reinvestment. It doesn't mean giving unconditionally. Generosity means giving in a way where you see that there's an appreciation, there's a value to it, and not giving it away for nothing entirely. And so in a business, the ability to create an environment of generosity, the ability to inspire a team of people to be generous, the ability to inspire the frontline person who deals with a customer to be generous. And again, generosity doesn't mean giving your goods away for nothing. Generosity means adding value. Having your customer go away and say, wow, that experience was worth so much more than I paid for it. That's what generosity means. Just making sure that the intangible and the tangible together makes the experience for the customer really worthwhile. And the investor says, being invested in this company is an honor and a privilege. so that each person who comes into contact, not only with one's company, but with oneself as a person, because we're all in business, we're all adding value, we're all providing service. And we want to ensure that in every interaction, whenever we're touching a person throughout the day, casually or formally, we're adding value. We're allowing that person to go away feeling, wow, that was amazing. I got so much more out of that than I put in. If we're all focused on giving more than we take, then we have an opportunity not only to build a superb society or organization, but most important of all, our own growth. And yes, the world in which we live seems to reward the greedy. The world in which we live seems to provide quick profits to people who are ready to grab them. That's the resistance. That's the gym. It's true. Let your weights go and they drop and they fall. The earth is pulling them downwards. You're trying to push them upwards. And every time you defy the gravitational force and you push your weights upwards, you develop strength within yourself. And so every time you defy the rules of greed and you push upwards and you uplift the people around you and you uplift your activities, you build strength within you. You build strength of character. You build spiritual strength. And that's the process of Musar. That's what Musar really is. I want to share with you, before we close off and take some questions, a tool that I developed and use with clients. So here we're talking about leaders of massive businesses, Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies around the world. And we're talking about leaders at various different levels in the organization, from the very top to those down below. And I'm teaching them how to use business as a vehicle for Musa, or as I often say in my work, how to make your business into a university of human greatness, how to make your business a place where people become great, where talent wants to work there, not just because of the salaries you pay, but talent wants to work there because of the opportunity you provide for spiritual growth and for human growth. That's what a business should be doing, and the profits are, I won't say secondary, but the profits are outcomes of great people putting others before themselves, providing great service, and adding value continuously. That's what a great business is. And so I take them through this tool, and we can have the next slide now, and we'll build it up ring by ring. And what I did here was I asked myself what the basis, what the foundation was of universal ethics. I realized I would have to be teaching this to people of many different religions and cultures. Could I find something universal and global enough for any person to latch on to, no matter what their religion or cultural background is? And so I went back to the Torah, to love your neighbor as yourself, and realized that that finds itself in every major religious text in one form or another. And in doing so, I argue that loving yourself, valuing yourself, appreciating who you are, is the foundation of all ethics. Ethics doesn't begin. You can't begin to care about others if you're undermining yourself. And so I ask myself a little further, so what is there about me that is worthy of that value? What is there about me that I can love in that particular way? And I said it's about the fact that I can make a contribution that is unique. Each individual is created with a purpose. Every individual is put on this world to make a difference. Some of us are put here to make a difference to nations, to the whole world, to the Jewish people, to a large organization of people. Some of us maybe are put here to make a difference in the lives of one person or a small number of people who in turn will make a difference. It doesn't matter, but we're here to serve. La'avda or la'shomra, we're here to make a difference. And each of us is provided with unique tools and capabilities to make a difference that nobody else can make. And that's the source of self-love. That's the source of self-value. I need to value myself, and each of you need to value yourselves, because you've been created with a capacity to make a difference in this world that nobody else can make quite as you can. And so let's build up to the next circle on the slide. That allows you to value yourself, and the next circle, which allows you as a result of that to value other people. So now I'm able to say, not only do I realize that I'm here for a unique purpose, but so is everybody. And everybody has a role to play. And there are things that you can do that I'm not designed to do. There are things you can do better than me. And that doesn't make me feel bad in any way, because I know there are things that I can do better than you can. Each of us has our constellation of talents, capabilities, and attributes, and our life situation that enables each of us to do something better and different from anybody else. And so if you just think of this as concentric circles, almost like ripples in a pond, if you're able to understand your own uniqueness of contribution, you can value yourself. Once you value yourself, you can value the uniqueness in others. And so let's progress to the next circle. Once you're able to value the uniqueness in others, you can show respect for every individual. So respect is not as a precondition. We don't start off respecting. Respect comes as an outcome of recognizing the capacity of every individual to make a unique difference. That's what makes them valuable and what makes them worthy of your respect. And since you respect them and you respect yourself, you're going to want to make sure that they feel appreciated. And so moving to the next circle, we reciprocate generosity of others, and perhaps a better way of wording this is we show gratitude for the generosity of others. By showing gratitude, we encourage generosity. One of the biggest inhibitors of generosity is lack of gratitude, fear of exploitation. If I give things away to you, if I give of myself to you, if I put your interests before mine, what will happen to me? That's the fear. But if I'm working with somebody that I trust, appreciates me, values me, respects me, and shows gratitude, then that generosity just flourishes. And so in a business, we teach people to value yourself and your own contribution. That allows you to value others, respect them. And now start showing them gratitude for everything they do. And that will lead to the next circle on the slide, which is giving them, and they will provide you. You will provide one another with material and intellectual generosity. Generosity is not only material. Generosity is a generosity of ideas, generosity of thought, emotional generosity, connecting with people, making people feel valued, which leads us to the next circle in the slide, which is doing that which is most valuable for people. People more than anything want to feel valued. It's quite interesting. We've done research, and others have done more extensive research than I have, as to what people's biggest need is. Quite apart from their physical survival, their most important need is to feel valued, to feel recognized, to feel respected by others. And so when you're securing yourself and you appreciate what others can contribute, you make them feel valued as well. This is a function of a person in a business, whether you're managing other people in a team or you're dealing with a customer. In the workplace, what we need to be doing constantly is make the other feel valued. Because when you make the other feel valued, you come to the next circle in the slide, which is loyalty. People feel attached to those who value them and make them feel valuable. We always say we want loyalty. We want loyalty in our relationships. We want faithfulness. We want loyal customers. We want loyal employees. Yes, but we've got to create the conditions for loyalty. And the condition for loyalty is to make people feel valued. Who wouldn't be loyal to someone who makes us feel valued? It's so important for us. It nourishes us. Why wouldn't we be loyal to such a person? And you can only make somebody feel valued if you've created an environment of generosity. And to create an environment of generosity, there needs to be gratitude. And so we go down to the end of it. And now, again, if we're in the workplace, what does loyalty generate? Here we come to the next circle, which is if we're able to get loyalty, we can get real customer focus. Because imagine now I have customers, or rather I have salespeople working with customers who feel incredibly loyal to my organization. And the reason they feel loyal is because they feel enormously valuable and enormously valued. And they know they are treated generously. They don't have to squeeze anything out of the customer, and they certainly don't have to treat the customer badly. On the contrary, they feel so secure. They feel so cared for. They feel so respected that all of their emotional energy can be focused on the customer. And the result of that is the final rung in this particular model, which is premium. Once that's the case, once I have an organization functioning with this methodology and functioning along this within this framework, then I am able to attract premium. Premium means I can be a little more expensive than my competitor and my customers will still be loyal to me. Premium might be, I might not be as convenient as my competitor, but my customers will still remain loyal and attached to me because my business is built on principles of Musar. If you look at each one of these rungs, each one of them is a Musar principle. And what this model is designed to show is how if you start with Musar and you build your business or you build your workplace around principles of Musar, the outcome, the result of that is premium. The result of that is bottom line. And so, and this is something we've measured actually. We're having worked with clients now around the world on this methodology for over 20 years. We're able to look at sustained track record and we're able to find phenomenal exponential results. Why this is important for me is not so much that the purpose of my life is to help my clients become richer. That's not the purpose of my life. That's an outcome. The purpose of my life is to demonstrate the system of the Torah. That when God said, I've put you here, la'ovda or la'shomra, and that means two things. It means to serve. It means to serve God by being ethical and by being proper and by developing character and by growing spiritually. And it means to serve in a workplace. And they are the same because if we serve correctly in a workplace, we're building character. If we build our character in a workplace, we're satisfying customers. And the two merge, the two intersect. This whole career of mine has been an experiment in Musar in the workplace. What happens to bottom line if your business is built on principles of Musar? And these principles of Musar that I've developed here are not specific to the Jewish people. These are universal principles that the Torah has taught the world, not just the Jewish people. The Jewish people have some additional requirements in terms of the way they work and how they relate to their workplace. But this is universal. This is global. And the results that we find here are phenomenal. So, yes, Musar in the workplace, it's not just Musar in the workplace, it's Musar through the workplace. God created the world in such a way that we need to trade, that we need to take care of the garden, otherwise it will deteriorate, that we need to take care of our businesses, otherwise they will deteriorate. We need to take care of our customers, our investors, so that we can find ourselves in an environment with spiritual gravity that tends to pull us down, and in that environment, we can lift the weights by acting correctly, by acting ethically, by acting morally in each situation in which we find ourselves. And the energy and effort we exert in doing that builds who we are and builds our character. And that's the purpose of our existence. That's the purpose of our being here, is to build our character through service. To build our character through chesed, through kindness, through service, through empathizing with another, and to find oneself in an environment where that's not the natural thing to do, but it's the right thing to do. And as it emerges, it in fact is the profitable thing to do. And again, as I mentioned earlier, when we talk about the workplace and I'm talking about business, every one of us is in the workplace almost every minute of our lives. Any situation in which we find ourselves, where we can be in service to another, we're in business because we're serving. And our profits don't have to be financial profits. There are many other ways through which we benefit from acts of service. But that's our choice at all times. Are we in service? Are we adding value? Are we making the other feel valued? Are we inspiring their connection and loyalty because of the degree to which we're making them feel valued? And that's whether we're dealing with a person in a business, we might be the customer, we might be a little irritated, but are we making the person on the other side feel valued? It might be another human being we just intersect with, somebody sitting next to one on the plane or in a subway or a bus. Are we making that person feel valued? There's an opportunity. There's an opportunity to serve another human being. It might be with a smile. It might be with a kind word. It might be with a compliment. It might be with some insight. Whatever it is, there's an opportunity to serve, to help, to care for, to empathize with another. And in so doing, to not only strengthen the fabric of society, but also to strengthen one's own moral character and to fulfill the purpose for which we were created, la'ovda u'la'shomra, to work the world and to protect the world, to work our souls and our moral muscles and to protect ourselves and our moral fiber. That's the purpose of man. So I would like to leave off at this point and hope that there might be some interesting comments. These are some contacts. The rabbilatin.com is a great resource of various aspects of Torah that I've taught over the last 25 years. It includes